Dr. Kislanko, from 1989 to 2001, you worked as a senior officer with Canada Immigration at Lester B. Pearson Airport, where you dealt with many high-profile national security cases. What were some of the major areas of concern?
Yeah, well, so 89 to 2001, obviously, was pre-9/11. I think my students like to think I had something to do with 9/11 because I left about a month before. I dealt with everything. I mean, in that business, you deal with, you know, grandmothers coming from Poland to rock stars, you know, coming to perform in Toronto. So it's not exclusively national security. But that being said, I was cleared at a higher level, and I think by virtue of the fact I was doing my PhD, given a whole bunch of cases that dealt with international security issues. So, you know, it's not that different. I now teach a course on terrorism, so I say this openly. It's not that different. I mean, Al-Qaeda wasn't really well known, and nobody had heard of ISIS, of course, and stuff like this back in that day. You know, there were still terrorists, and we were still looking for and trying to combat terrorists. It's just they were on a different list, as I say. The flavor of the day had changed, right?
Right.
So, you know, I'm so old that I remember, you know, us looking for, you know, the Red Army and the Basque separatist group ETA and stuff like this. So, you know, terrorism was always a threat. It is a threat. It's now substantially bigger. I think that's true. But, you know, it's just changed sort of orientation. And it's the same story for organized crime. And I think organized crime today, and maybe colleagues of mine or former colleagues of mine who are still in the business would obviously be able to attest better, but organized crime is a major threat to Canada. And it sort of gets, you know, not enough attention because of terrorism. Terrorism is sexier, right? As I always say, it's kind of more spectacular. It's, you know, more foreign.
I think it's more of a shock value.
It's a shock value.
As soon as it happens, people will talk about it.
You bet.
And then after a couple weeks, people forget.
That's right. And terrorism always, almost, you know, invariably ends up very sadly, of course, you know, aimed at innocence, right? There has this sort of obvious tendency, graphic in nature and so on. Organized crime kind of flies underneath the radar screen in a lot of ways. But it was a major threat, and I dealt, you know, with some organized crime cases, and they're still a huge threat. Again, they've changed. They're fantastically organized, some of the groups, and very, you know, they're like octopuses. They have, you know, they have enormous range and reach and tentacles everywhere. So I think that's a major threat. And certainly, you know, it's a sensitive topic and one that needs to be broached accordingly, but you know, refugee issues, and particularly in light of what's going on today in Europe, you know, I have to watch what I say, right? Because I'm a huge fan of immigration. It's kind of an apologia coming here. My concern then, and I think it's also a concern now, is that, you know, Canada's refugee system has been targeted in the past by people that aren't legitimately refugees. So that does not mean that all people coming to the country aren't legitimate. It means that some people take full advantage of a very open and generous system. And, you know, that sometimes has, you know, nefarious purposes behind it. Not necessarily terrorism, organized crime, but sometimes just, you know, coming to take advantage of Canada in some respect. So again, you know, I really want to make it quite clear. I think Canada has major international obligations to assist those in dire need of our help. And frankly, we haven't done a very good job over the last, you know, here's the politics coming, right? Certainly over the last 10 or so years, we've done a dismal job helping people in dire need. Where Canadians, I think, are really misled is that the folks actually coming here aren't always legitimate, right?
Do you think there should be a screening process, an extensive screening process for anyone, not just for the refugees that are coming into this country, into Canada from Syria.
Yeah.
It can be someone from Poland, from Europe, from any country outside of
Canada. No question. And we have that theoretically when you're dealing with other dimensions of immigration, but when it comes to refugee determination, it's quite different. And up until a few years ago when the Harper government changed it, it was a much more open-ended system where virtually anybody could come in. From all over. And when I was an officer, we had refugee claims from the United States, Sweden, the United Kingdom, you know, places that would probably make you think about legitimacy. But even with that in tow, what my concern is, and it's a very serious one, is that Canadians think to some degree, even still, that the folks that show up and say, I'm a refugee, automatically are, because they say so, or that they're sort of conjuring up images of the Sunday morning, you know, advertisements where you see, you know, Care Canada and all this, asking for money, and you see the images of, you know, unbelievable deprivation, starvation, misery in places like Africa. I never saw those people. Never once. And the reason I'm very adamant about pointing that out is because Canadians, I think, sometimes confuse themselves, imagining that that's who we're talking about, when in fact those people die. They can't get out. Like, they don't have passports, they don't have resources, they don't have airline tickets, they can't conjure up the resources to hire smugglers to get them into the country illegally. So when Canada doesn't do enough to help people legitimately in harm's way overseas, we don't process them there. I know it's a lot of money, but, you know, that's our international obligation as far as I'm concerned.
I agree in terms of protecting
the
citizens of this country. I think it's essential to check and to cross-reference.
You bet. And to help those in need, right?
I agree.
So we used to do that. We used to send folks to, you know, horrible situations, war zones and you know, calamities and so on. And we don't, you know, as much anymore. And what it leads to is a system where we sort of say, you come to us and then we'll decide. But of course, that only favors those who have particular means, right? So that's where the kids with the bloated bellies and the hollow eyes aren't coming. So, you know, frankly, it's different coming from a former officer because, you know, you might imagine that, you know, we say, there's no such thing as a refugee. It's not true. There's, you know, so many legitimate people in legitimate need of our help, but we don't see them, right, as much. And so why I'm saying that is because a lot of people who come, you know, do present problems to Canada, and I don't believe Canadians are willing or able to talk about that because they're so afraid of being called out for being, what, prejudicial, racist, whatever. And I think we need to be more sophisticated in that discussion.
You know? I think we need to understand that someone who wants to ensure the identity of a person coming into any country, is not racist. It's not a matter of racism.
That's
you know, to be accused of being a racist when you're simply requesting to see the identification of a person, whether that person is from Europe, from Asia, any part of the country, that's a mandatory requirement.
Sure. And I just think also, like, this current crisis, and I was watching it and did some media stuff and everything else, you know, a lot of Canadians were seeing the images of what they assumed were Syrians on television, and they weren't. I mean, you could tell that they weren't. They were from India and other parts of Africa. So I'm not saying that, you know, those people also don't have a legitimate claim to refugee status. But, you know, we need to be, you know, choosy. I mean, you know, until the utopian world descends where we have no borders and everybody's absolutely equal everywhere, the reality of our society and, you know, I think most societies is that borders still count. They're still necessary. And I think Canadians who entertain thoughts, you know, dramatically otherwise are really fooling themselves, right? We simply cannot accept, you know, hundreds of millions of people around the world who are on the move, nor can any country. So obviously you need to scrutinize to some degree. I think we've done a dismal job in Syria. I think we could have moved much faster, much better to balance our national security considerations against the overwhelming humanitarian needs of those people. But in that milieu, you saw lots and lots of people who very clearly weren't from Syria and Iraq. And many Canadians didn't bother to distinguish. They don't care. I personally do care. I want to make sure that if we have room for 30,000 people, that those are the 30,000 that really need our help, or as close as we can get to it, not 20,000 with another 10,000 mixed in who are economic migrants who want a better way of life. I sympathize with them. I do the same thing. And as a former officer, I'll tell you, a lot of people came to this country with totally bogus refugee claims. But, you know, I wish them luck, right? I do the same thing. Who wouldn't want to live in this country? But you can't have that kind of, you know, system. It's an anathema. Right, to international security.
And then ultimately it's taking advantage of a system that's meant to be strong.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's another thing I wanted to ask you pertaining to migrants is, how do you see the United States of America treating the migrants and the crisis in Syria right now in comparison to the work that Canada is doing?
Well, I would rank Canada right at the bottom of the barrel, to be really frank with you. I mean, I think we did a dismal job off of the start. And I do actually understand why, right? Overwhelming concerns about ISIS being mixed in with the flow. But we could have done so much more. The United States can also do more. I mean, you know, it's going to be the same for almost any country you ask, because, you know, we could have all done more and could do more now to help those in dire need. As an academic, I understand why, and a former government guy, I understand why they haven't. You know, processes take time to build. You need to actually have people on the ground, resources allocated. You know, it's much more complicated than simply showing up with a whole bunch of Canadian Tire tents and water and stuff like that. You need permissions, right? If you're going to go there, you need, you know, to barter sovereignty issues with Jordan or Turkey or whatever the case may be. But all that being said, even when you factor that in, we've done a poor job. And the United States, I think, has done a marginally better job. But, you know, not to be overly political, this to some degree, you know, is more of their responsibility, I suppose. And also they have a greater capacity to respond, right, with a preponderant, you know, military and economic presence in the area and allies in the area, too, that can do their bidding and more resources in general. But the response from the Western community, you know, has been bad. European countries are now paying the price for it. They're getting squeezed because the
Germany
masses need it.
Germany has done a lot in terms Germany's of done a,
yeah,
the
you're,
migrants.
You're totally right. Germany, I would give, you know, not that anybody listens to me, but, you know, Germany should get high marks for what it's tried to do at the very least. So that is true. You're right. But everybody else, you know, really does, you know, need to be called upon to answer. And I say that with firm conviction, so much so that I think, and, you know, all my former colleagues must forgive me, I would rather err on the side of bringing in desperate people and run the risk of getting a couple of bad eggs in that basket rather than waiting to sort out the bad eggs, hoping you can ever do so, right? Because many of them are too clever. And then turning away thousands of people who need our help. I think that's morally wrong of us.
Dr. Kishlenko, one of your publications, The Uneasy Century, International Relations, 1900 to 1990, mentioned some of the challenges that were experienced in that period of time. Would you be able to discuss the significance of this publication along with how that period of time has changed?
Sure. So that was a documentary history we put together. It was with Margaret McMillan, actually, and I was her TA way back then, and an apprentice, I suppose. We did a book of documents, and that book is now going to be coming out again, as it were, because I'm doing that and another book.
When is it coming out?
Well, hopefully soon, let's say that, along with an actual text on history of international relations. So what we covered, obviously, was a lot about the outbreak of World War I, World War II, sort of followed a logical historical shtick, as it were, and then the Cold War. And through documents, and of course historians live and die by documents, you know, we mapped out some of the major events, also not just in terms of chronology, but also in terms of region. So I do a lot on the Vietnam War, so there's a very, you know, big section on Indochina. I think for students out there, and it's my shameless plug, I suppose, for historians in particular, you know, looking at documents, primary documents, really brings a new dimension into the study of international relations, and that is, we're so lucky in this day and age, you can access them, you know, online. I get frustrated at my students because, you know, I never had that advantage, right? You had to go to the library.
I think it's great having accessibility to all of the news on the internet.
Well, they can even access archives. Like, there's some, you know, fantastic projects out there, Cold War International History Project, Avalon Project at Yale. You know, amazing stores of archival information that you can get readily. And you know, that's something that I'll always do moving forward, is whenever, you know, you're asked to write something like a big textbook or something like that, is to have a documentary accompaniment. So that's what that book was, a documentary, you know, analysis, if you like, of the world in the 20th century. Yeah.